Side 3, The Divine Invasion, by Philip K. Dick, continuing on page 83. As he stood by his desk, warming the snifter with the palms of his hands, his wife, Galina, entered the room. "Make no appointments for Thursday night," she said. "General Yakir has planned a recital for the Moscow Corps. The American chanteuse Linda Fox will be singing. Yakir expects us."
"Certainly," Bulkovsky said. "Have roses prepared for the end of the recital." To a pair of robot servants, he said, "Have my valet de chambre remind me."
"Don't nod off during the recital," Galina said. "Mrs. Yakir will be hurt. You remember the last time."
"The Penderecki abomination," Bulkovsky said, remembering well. He had snored through the Quia Fecit of the Magnificat, and then read about his behavior in intelligence documents a week later.
"Remember that as far as informed circles know, you are a born-again Christian," Galina said. "What did you do about those responsible for the loss of the three arks?"
"They are all dead," Bukovsky said. He had had them shot.
"You could recruit replacement from the UK.
"We will have our own soon. I don't trust what the UK sends us. Everyone is for sale. For instance, how much is that chanteuse now asking for her decision?"
"The situation is confused," Galina said. "I have read the intelligence reports. The Cardinal is offering her a large sum to decide for the CIC. I don't think we should try to meet it."
"But if an entertainer that popular were to step forth and announce that she had seen the white light and accepted sweet Jesus into her life..."
"You did."
"But," Bulkovsky said, "you know why. As he had accepted Jesus solemnly, with much pomp, he would presently declare that he had renounced Jesus and returned, wiser now, to the SL. This would have a dire effect on the Curia, and hopefully even on the Cardinal himself. The chief prelate's morale, according to SL psychologists, would be shattered. The man actually supposed that one day everyone associated with the SL would march up to the various offices of the CIC and convert."
"What are you doing about that doctor he sent?" Galina said. "Are there any difficulties?"
"No."
He shook his head. "The forged medical reports keep him busy." Actually, the medical information presented regularly to the physician whom the Cardinal had sent were not forged. They simply pertained to someone other than Bulkovsky, some minor SL person genuinely sick. Bulkovsky had sworn Harms's physician to secrecy, pleading medical ethics as the issue. But of course, Dr. Duffy covertly dispatched detailed reports on the procurator's health to the Cardinal's staff at every opportunity. SL intelligence routinely intercepted them, checked to make sure they painted a sufficiently grave picture, copied them, and sent them on. By and large, the medical reports traveled by microwave signal to an orbiting CIC communications satellite, and from there were beamed down to Washington, D.C. However, Dr. Duffy, in a periodic fit of cleverness, sometimes simply mailed the information. This was harder to control. Imagining that he was dealing with an ailing man, and one who had decided for Jesus, the Cardinal had relaxed his stance of vigil regarding the higher activities of the SL. The Cardinal now supposed the procurator to be hopelessly incompetent. "If Linda Fox will not decide for the SL," Galina said, "why don't you draw her aside and tell her that one day, on her way to a concert engagement, her private rocket, that gaudy plush thing she flies herself, will go up in a flash of flaming fire?" Gloomily, Bulkovsky said, "Because the Cardinal got to her first. He has already passed the word to her that if she doesn't accept sweet Jesus into her life, bichlorides will find her whether she wants to accept them or not." The tactic of poisoning Linda Fox with small doses of mercury was an artful one. Long before she died, if she did die, she would be as mad as a hatter. Literally, since it had been mercury poisoning, mercury used to process felt hats that had driven the English hatters of the 19th century into famous organic psychosis. "I wish I had thought of that," Bulkovsky said to himself. Intelligence reports stated that the chanteuse had become hysterical when informed by a CIC agent of what the Cardinal intended if she did not decide for Jesus. Hysteria and then temporary hypothermia, followed by a refusal to sing Rock of Ages in her next concert, as had been scheduled. On the other hand, he reflected, cadmium would be better than mercury because it would be more difficult to detect. The SL secret police had used trace amounts of cadmium on persons for some time, and to good effect. Then money won't influence her, Galina said. I wouldn't dismiss it. It's her ambition to own Greater Los Angeles. Galina said, but if she is destroyed, the colonists will grumble. They're dependent on her. Linda Fox is not a person. She is a class of persons, a type. She is a sound that electronic equipment, very sophisticated electronic equipment, makes. There are more of her. There will always be. She can be stamped out like tires. Well, then don't offer her very much money, Galina laughed. I feel sorry for her, Bukowski said. How must it feel, he asked himself, not to exist? That's a contradiction. To feel is to exist. Then, he thought, probably she does not feel, because it is a fact that she does not exist, not really. We ought to know. We were the first to imagine her. Or rather, Big Noodle had first imagined the fox. The AI system had invented her, told her what to sing and how to sing it. Big Noodle set up her arrangements, even down to the mixing, and the package was a complete success. Big Noodle had correctly analyzed the emotional needs of the colonists and had come up with a formula to meet those needs. The AI system maintained an ongoing survey, deriving feedback. When the needs changed, Linda Fox changed. It constituted a closed loop. If suddenly all the colonists disappeared, Linda Fox would wink out of existence. Big Noodle would have canceled her, like paper run through a paper shredder. Procurator, a robot serving assembly said, coasting up to Bukowski. What is it? He said irritably. He did not like to be interrupted when he was conversing with his wife. The robot serving assembly said, Hawk. To Galina, he said, Big Noodle wants me. It's urgent. You'll excuse me. He walked away from her rapidly and into his complex of private offices where he would find the carefully protected terminal of the AI system. The terminal indeed pulsed, waiting for him. Troop movements? Bukowski said as he seated himself facing the screen of the terminal. No, the artificial voice of Big Noodle came with its characteristic ambience. A conspiracy to smuggle a monster baby through immigration. Three colonists are involved. I monitored the fetus of the woman. Details to follow. Big Noodle broke the circuit. Details when? Bukowski said, but the AI system did not hear him, having cut itself off. Damn, he thought. It shows me little courtesy. Too busy deconstructing the ontological proof of the existence of God. Cardinal Fulton Statler Harms received the news from Big Noodle with his customary aplomb. Thank you very much, he said as the AI system signed off. Something alien, he said to himself. Some sport that God never intended should exist. This is the truly dreadful aspect of space migration. We do not get back what we send out. We get in return the unnatural. Well, he thought, we shall have it killed. However, I will be interested to see its brain print. I wonder what this one is like. A snake within an egg, he thought. A fetus within a woman. The original story retold. A creature that is subtle. The serpent was more crafty than any wild creature that the Lord God had made. Genesis chapter 3, verse 1. What happened before is not going to happen again. We will destroy it this time, the evil one, in whatever form it now has taken. He thought, I shall pray on it. Excuse me, he said to his small audience of visiting priests who waited outside in the vast lounge. I must retire to my chapel for a little while. A serious matter has come up. Presently he knelt in silence and gloom, with burning candles off in the far corners, the chamber and himself hallowed. Father, he prayed, Teach us to know thy ways and to emulate thee. Help us to protect ourselves and guard against the evil one. May we foresee and understand his wiles, for his wiles are great, his cunning also. Give us the strength, lend us thy holy power, to ferret him out wherever he is. He heard nothing in response. It did not surprise him. Pious people spoke to God, and crazy people imagined that God spoke back. His answers had to come from within himself, from his own heart. But, of course, the Spirit guided him. It was always thus. Within him, the Spirit, in the form of his own proclivities, ratified his original insight. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live, included in its domain the smuggled mutation. Witch equaled monster. He therefore had scriptural support. And anyhow, he was God's regent on earth. Just to be on the safe side, he consulted his huge copy of the Bible, rereading Exodus 22, verse 17. Thou shalt not suffer a sorceress to live. And then for good measure he read the next verse. Whosoever lieth with a beast shall surely be put to death. Then he read the notes. Ancient witchcraft was steeped in crime, immorality, and imposture, and it debased the populace by hideous practices and superstitions. It is preceded by provisions against sexual license and followed by condemnation of unnatural vice and idolatry. Well, that certainly applied here. Hideous practices and superstitions, things spawned by intercourse with non-humans on far-off foreign planets. They shall not invade this sacred world, he said to himself. I'm sure my colleague, the Procurator Maximus, will agree. Suddenly, illumination washed over him. We're being invaded, he realized. The thing we've been talking about for 2 centuries. The Holy Spirit is telling me. It has happened. A cursed spawn of filth, he thought. Rapidly he made his way to his master chamber, where the direct and highly shielded line to the Procurator could be found. Is this about the baby? Bukowski said when contact, in an instant, had been established. I have retired for the night. It can wait until tomorrow. There is an abomination out there, Cardinal Harms said. Exodus 22, verse 17. Thou big noodle won't let it reach Earth. It must have been intercepted at one of the outer rings of immigration. God does not wish monsters on this, his primary world. You, as a born-again Christian, should realize that. Certainly I do, Bukowski said with indignation. What shall I instruct Big Noodle to do? Bukowski said, It's what will Big Noodle instruct us to do, rather, don't you think? We will have to pray our way through this crisis, Harms said. Join me now in a prayer. Bow your head. My wife is calling me, Bukowski said. We can pray tomorrow. Good night. He hung up. O God of Israel, Harms prayed, his head bowed, protect us from procrastination and from the evil that has descended on it. Awaken the Procurator's soul to the urgency of this, our hour of ordeal. We are being spiritually tested, he prayed. I know that is the case. We must prove our worth by casting out this satanic presence. Make us worthy, Lord. Lend us thy sword of might. Give us thy saddle of righteousness to mount the steed of... He could not finish the thought. It was too intense. Hasten to our aid, he finished, and raised his head. A sense of triumph filled him, as if he thought, We have trapped something to be killed. We have hunted it down, and it will die. Praise be to God. 8. The high-velocity axial flight made Ribis Rami deathly ill. United Spaceways had arranged for 5 adjoining seats for her so that she could lie outstretched. Even so, she was barely able to speak. She lay on her side, a blanket up to her chin. Somberly, as he gazed down at the woman, Elias Tate said, "The damn legal technicalities. If we hadn't been held up..." He grimaced. Within Ribis's body, the fetus, now 6 months along, had been silent for a vast amount of time. "What if the fetus dies?" Herb Asher asked himself. "The death of God. But not under circumstances anyone ever anticipated. And no one, except himself, Ribis, and Elias Tate, would ever know. Can God die?" he wondered. "And with him, my wife?" The marriage ceremony had been lucid and brief, a transaction by the deep space authorities, with no religious or moral overtones. Both he and Ribis had been required to undergo extensive physical examinations, and of course her pregnancy had been discovered. "You're the father?" the doctor asked him. "Yes," Herb Asher said. The doctor grinned and noted that on his chart. "We felt we had to get married," Herb said. "It's a good attitude." The doctor was elderly and well-groomed and totally impersonal. "Are you aware that it's a boy?" "Yes," he said. He certainly was. "There is one thing I do not understand," the doctor said. "Was this impregnation natural? It wasn't artificial insemination by any chance, because the hymen is intact." "Really?" Herb Asher said. "It's rare, but it can happen. So technically your wife is still a virgin." "Really?" Herb Asher said. The doctor said, "She is quite ill, you know, from the multiple sclerosis." "I know," he answered stoically. "There is no guarantee of a cure. You realize that. I think it's an excellent idea to return her to Earth, and I heartily approve of your going along with her. But it may be for nothing. MS is a peculiar ailment. The myelin sheath of the nerve fibers develops hard patches, and this eventually results in permanent paralysis. We have finally isolated two causal factors after decades of intensive effort. There is a microorganism, but, and this is a major factor, a form of allergy is involved. Much of the treatment involves transforming the immune system so that..." The doctor continued on, and Herb Asher listened as well as he could. He knew it all already. Ribis had told him several times, and had shown him texts that she had obtained from MED. Like her, he had become an authority on the disease. "Could I have some water?" Ribis murmured, lifting her head. Her face was blotched and swollen, and Herb Asher could understand her only with difficulty. A stewardess brought Ribis a paper cup of water. Elias and Herb lifted her to a sitting position, and she took the cup in her hands. Her arms, her body, trembled. "It won't be much longer," Herb Asher said. "Christ," Ribis murmured, "I don't think I'm going to make it. Tell the stewardess I'm going to throw up again. Make her bring back that bowl. Jesus." She sat up fully, her face stricken with pain. The stewardess, bending down beside her, said, "We'll be firing the retrojets in 2 hours, so if you can just hold on." "Hold on," Ribis said. "I can't even hold on to what I drank. Are you sure that Coke wasn't tainted or something? I think it made me worse. Don't you have any ginger ale? If I had some ginger ale, maybe I could keep from..." She cursed with venom and rage. "Damn this," she said. "Damn all this. It isn't worth it." She stared at Herb Asher and then Elias. "Yah," Herb Asher thought. "Can't you do anything? It's sadistic to let her suffer this way." Within his mind, a voice spoke. He could not at first fathom what it meant. He heard the words, but they seemed to make no sense. The voice said, "Take her to the garden." He thought, "What garden?" "Take her by the hand." Herb Asher, reaching down, fumbling in the folds of the blanket, took his wife's hand. "Thank you," Ribis said. Feebly, she squeezed his hand. Now, as he sat leaning over her, he saw her eyes shine. He saw spaces beyond her eyes, as if he were looking into something empty, containing huge stretches of space. "Where are you?" he wondered. "It is a universe in there, within your skull. It is a different universe from this. Not a mirror reflection, but another land." He saw stars and clusters of stars. He saw nebulae and great clouds of gases that glowed darkly and yet still with a white light, not a ruddy light. He felt wind billow about him, and he heard something rustle. "Leaves or branches," he thought. "I hear plants." The air felt warm. That amazed him. It seemed to be fresh air, not the stale, recirculated air of the spaceship. The sound of birds, and when he looked up, blue sky. He saw bamboo, and the rustling sound came from the wind blowing through the canes of bamboo. He saw a fence, and there were children. And yet at the same time he still held his wife's weak hand. Strange, he thought. The air so dry, as if it comes sweeping off the desert. He saw a boy with brown curly hair. The boy's hair reminded him of Ribis's hair before she had lost it. Before, from the chemotherapy, it had fallen out and disappeared. "Where am I?" he wondered. "At a school?" Beside him, fussy Mr. Plowdett told him pointless stories having to do with the school's financial needs, the school's problems. He wasn't interested in the school's problems. He was interested in his son's brain damage. He wanted to know all about it. "What I can't understand," Plowdett was saying, "is why they kept you in suspension for 10 years for a spleen. For heaven's sake, a splenectomy is a normal and regular type of surgery, and there is frequently a splenolysis that can be..." "Which hemisphere of his brain is damaged?" Herb Asher interrupted. "Mr. Tate has all the medical reports, but I'll go to our computer and ask for a printout. Manny seems a little afraid of you, but I suppose it's because he's never seen his father before." "I'll stay out here with him," Herb said, "while you get me the printout. I want to know as much as possible about the injury."
"Herb," Ribis said.
Startled, he realized where he was. Aboard the United Spaceways XR-4 axial flight from Fomalhaut to the Sol system. In 2 hours, the first immigration party would board the ship and make their preliminary inspection.
"Herb," his wife whispered, "I just saw my son."
"A school," Herb Asher said, "where he's going to go."
"I don't think I'll live to be there," Ribis said. "I have a feeling he was there, and you were there, and a noisy little rat-like man who babbled on, but I wasn't anywhere around. I looked. I kept looking. This really is going to kill me, but it won't kill my son. That's what he told me, remember? Yah told me I would live on through my son, so I guess I will die. I mean, this body will die, but they'll save him. Were you there when Yah said that? I don't remember. That was a garden we were in, wasn't it? Bamboo. I saw the wind blowing. The wind talked to me. It was like voices."
"Yes," he said.
"They used to go out in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. Elijah, and then Jesus."
"Elias?"
She looked around.
"You ate locusts and wild honey and called on men to repent. You told King Ahab there would be no dew nor rain these years. Thus says the Lord, according to my word."
She shut her eyes.
"She is really sick," Herb Asher said to himself. "But I saw her son, beautiful and wild and something more, timid. Very human," he thought. "That was a human child. Maybe this is all in our minds. Maybe the Clems have occluded our perceptions so that we believe and see and experience, but it is not real." "I give up," he thought. "I just don't know." "Something to do with time. He seems able to transform time. Now I am here in the ship,
But then I am in the garden with the child and the other children, her child, years from now. What is the true time? He asked himself. Me here in the ship, or back in my dome before I met Ribis, or after she is dead and Emmanuel is in school. And I have been in cryonic suspension for a matter of years. It has to do, or had to do, or will have to do, with my spleen. Did they shoot me? He wondered. Ribis died from her illness. But how did I die? And what became, or will become, of Elias? Leaning toward him, Elias said, I want to talk to you. He motioned Herb Asher away from Ribis and away from the other passengers. We are not to mention Yah. We will use the word Jehovah from now on. It's a word coined in 1530. It's all right to say it. You understand the situation. Immigration will try to tap our minds with psychotronic listening devices, but Jehovah will cloud our minds, and they will get little or nothing. But this is the part that is hard to say. Jehovah's power wanes from here on. The zone of Belial begins soon. Okay, he nodded. You know all this, and a lot more. From what Elias had told him, and from what Ribis had told him, and Jehovah had told him much in his sleep, in vivid dreams, Jehovah had been teaching all of them. They would know what to do. Elias said, He is with us, and can address us from her womb. But there is always the possibility that very advanced electronic scanning devices, monitoring devices, might pick it up. He will converse with us sparingly. After a pause, he added, If at all. A strange idea, Herb Asher said. I wonder what the authorities would think if their intelligence-gathering circuitry picked up the thoughts of God. Well, Elias said, They wouldn't know what it was. I know the authorities of Earth. I have dealt with them for 4,000 years, in situation after situation, country after country, war after war. I was with Graf Egermont in the Dutch Wars of Independence, the 30 Years' War. I was present the day he was executed. I knew Beethoven, but perhaps knew is not the word. You were Beethoven, Herb Asher said. Part of my spirit returned to Earth and to him, Elias said. Vulgar and fiery, Herb thought, passionately dedicated to the cause of human freedom, walking hand in hand with his friend Goethe, the two men stirring the new life of the German Enlightenment. Who else were you? He said. Many people in history. Tom Paine? We engineered the American Revolution, Elias said. A group of us. We were the Friends of God at one time, and the Brothers of the Rosy Cross in 1615. I was Jakob Boehme, but you wouldn't know of him. My spirit doesn't dwell alone in a man. It is not incarnation. It is part of my spirit returning to Earth to bond with a human whom God has selected. There are always such humans, and I am there. Martin Buber was one such man. God rest his noble soul. That dear and gentle man. The Arabs, too, placed flowers on his grave. Even the Arabs loved him. Elias fell silent. Some of the men I sent myself to were better men than I was, but I have the power to return. God granted it to me to... Well, it was for Israel's sake. A hint of immortality for the dearest people of all. You know, Herb, God offered the Torah, it is said, to every people in the world, back in ancient times, before he offered it to the Jews, and every nation rejected it for one reason or another. The Torah said, Thou shalt not kill, and many could not live by that. They wanted religion to be separate from morality. They didn't want religion to hobble their desires. Finally, God offered it to the Jews, who accepted it. The Torah is the law, Herb said. It is more than the law. The word law is inadequate. Even though the New Testament of the Christians always uses the word law for Torah, Torah is the totality of divine disclosure by God. It is alive. It existed before creation. It is a mystic, almost cosmic entity. The Torah is the Creator's instrument. With it, He created the universe, and for it, He created the universe. It is the highest idea and the living soul of the world. Without it, the world could not exist, and would have no right to exist. I am quoting the great Hebrew poet Chaim Nachman Bialik, who lived from the latter part of the 19th century into the mid-20th century. You should read him sometime. Can you tell me anything else about the Torah? Reish Lakish said, "If one's intent is pure, the Torah for him becomes a life-giving medicine, purifying him to life. But if one's intent is not pure, it becomes a death-giving drug, purifying him to death." The two men remained silent for a time. "I will tell you something more," Elias said. "A man came to the great Rabbi Hillel. He lived in the 1st century CE, and said, 'I will become a proselyte on the condition that you teach me the entire Torah while I stand on one foot.' Hillel said, 'Whatever is hateful to you, do not do it to your neighbor. That is the entire Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn it.'" He smiled at Herb Asher. "Is the injunction actually in the Torah?" Herb Asher said. "The first 5 books of the Bible?" "Yes. Leviticus 19:18. God says, 'You shall love your neighbor as a man like yourself.' You did not know that, did you? Almost 2,000 years before Jesus." "Then the golden rule derives from Judaism," Herb said. "Yes, it does. And early Judaism. The rule was presented to man by God himself." "I have a lot to learn," Herb said. "Read," Elias said. "Cape lege," the two words Augustine heard. Latin for take, read. "You do that, Herb. Take the book and read it. It is there for you. It is alive." As their journey continued, Elias disclosed to him further intriguing aspects of the Torah, qualities regarding the Torah that few men knew. "I tell you these matters," Elias said, "because I trust you. Be careful whom you relate them to." 4 ways existed by which to read the Torah, the 4th being a study of its hidden, innermost side. When God said, "Let there be light," he meant the mystery that shone in the Torah. This was the concealed primordial light of creation itself, it being of such nobility that it could not be debased by the use of mortals. So God wrapped it up within the heart of the Torah. This was an inexhaustible light, related to the divine sparks which the Gnostics had believed in, the fragments of the Godhead which were now scattered throughout creation, enclosed, unfortunately, in material shells, that of physical bodies. Most interesting of all, some medieval Jewish mystics held the view that there had been 600,000 Jews who went out of Egypt and received the Torah at Mount Sinai. Reincarnated at each succeeding generation, these 600,000 souls continually live. Each soul or spark is related to the Torah in a different way. Thus, 600,000 separate, unique meanings of the Torah exist. The idea is as follows, that for each of these 600,000 persons, the Torah is different, and each person has his own specific letter in the Torah, to which his own soul is attached. So, in a sense, 600,000 Torahs exist. Also, 3 eons or epochs in time exist, the 1st in order being an age of grace, the 2nd or current one being of severe justice and limitation, and the next, yet to come, being of mercy. A different Torah exists for each of the 3 ages, And yet there is only one Torah. A primal or matrix Torah exists, in which there is no punctuation, nor any spaces between the words. In fact, all the letters are jumbled together. In each of the three ages, the letters form themselves into alternative words as events unfold. The current age, that of severe justice and limitation, Elias explained, is marred by the fact that in its Torah one of the letters was defective, the consonant shin. This letter was always written with three prongs, but it should have had four. Thus, the Torah produced for this age was defective. Another view held by medieval Jewish mystics was that a letter is actually missing in our alphabet. Because of this, our Torah contains negative laws as well as positive. In the next eon, the missing or invisible letter will be restored, and every negative prohibition in the Torah will disappear. Hence, this next eon, or as it is called in Hebrew, the next Shemitah, will lack restrictions imposed on humans. Freedom will replace severe justice and limitation. Out of this notion comes the idea, Elias said, that there are invisible portions of the Torah, invisible to us now, but to be visible in the messianic age that is to come. The cosmic cycle will bring this age inevitably. It will be the next Shemitah, very much like the first. The Torah will again rearrange itself out of its jumbled matrix. Herb Asher thought, it sounds like a computer. The universe is programmed, and then more accurately reprogrammed. Fantastic. 2 hours later, an official government ship clamped itself to their ship, and after a time, immigration agents began to move among them, beginning their inspection and their interrogation. Filled with fear, Herb Asher held Ribbis against him, and he sat as close to Elias as possible, obtaining strength from the older man. "Tell me, Elias," Herb said quietly, "the most beautiful thing you know about God." His heart pounded harshly within him, and he could scarcely breathe. Elias said, "All right." Rabbi Judah said, quoting Rav, "The day consists of 12 hours. During the first 3 hours, the Holy One, God, praised be He, is engaged in the study of Torah. During the second 3, He sits in judgment over His entire world. When He realizes that the world is deserving of destruction, He rises from the throne of justice to sit on the throne of mercy. During the third group of 3 hours, He provides sustenance for the entire world, from huge beasts to life. During the fourth, He sports with the Leviathan, as it is written, 'Leviathan which you did form to sport with.' Psalms 104:26. During the fourth group of 3 hours, according to others, He teaches school children." "Thank you," Herb Asher said. Three immigration agents were moving toward them now, their uniforms bright, shiny, and they carried weapons. Elias said, "Even God consults the Torah as the formula and blueprint of the universe." An immigration agent held out his hand for Elias's identification. The old man passed the packet of documents to him. "And even God cannot act contrary to it." "You are Elias Tate," the senior immigration agent said, examining the documents. "What is your purpose in returning to the Sol system?" "This woman is very ill," Elias said. "She is entering the naval hospital at..." "I asked you your purpose, not hers." He gazed down at Herb Asher. "Who are you?" "I'm her husband," Herb said. He handed over his identification and permits and documentation. "She is certified as not contagious?" the senior immigration agent said. "It's multiple sclerosis," Herb said, "which is not..." "I didn't ask you what she has. I asked you if it is contagious." "I'm telling you," he said. "I'm answering your question." "Get up." He stood. "Come with me." The senior immigration agent motioned Herb Asher to follow him up the aisle. Elias started to follow, but the agent shoved him back bodily. "Not you." Following the immigration agent, Herb Asher made his way step by step up the aisle to the rear of the ship. None of the other passengers was standing. He alone had been singled out. In a small compartment marked crew only, the senior immigration agent faced Herb Asher, staring at him silently. The man's eyes bulged as if he were unable to speak, as if what he had to say could not be said. Time passed. "What the hell is he doing?" Herb Asher asked himself. Silence. The raging stare continued. "Okay," the immigration agent said. "I give up. What is your purpose in returning to Earth?" "I told you." "Is she really sick?" "Very. She's dying." "Then she's too sick to travel. It makes no sense. Only on Earth are there facilities where..." "You are under Terran law now," the immigration agent said. "Do you want to serve time for giving false information to a federal officer? I'm sending you back to Fomalhaut. The three of you. I don't have any more time. Go back to where you were sitting and remain there until you're told what to do." A voice, a neutral, dispassionate voice, neither male nor female, a kind of perfect intelligence, spoke inside Herb Asher's head. "At Bethesda, they want to study her disease." He started visibly. The agent regarded him. "At Bethesda," he said, "they want to study her disease." "Research?" "It's a microorganism. You said it isn't contagious." The neutral voice said, "Not at this stage." "Not at this stage," he said aloud. "Are they afraid of plague?" the immigration agent said abruptly. Herb Asher nodded. "Go back to your seat." The agent irritably waved him away. "This is out of my jurisdiction. You have a pink form, Form 368, properly filled out and signed by a doctor?" "Yes." It was true. "Are either you or the older man with you infected?" The voice inside his head said, "Only Bethesda can determine that." He had, suddenly, a vivid inner glimpse of the person whose voice he heard. He saw in his own mind a visage, female, a placid but strong face. A metal mask had been pushed back from that visage, exposing wise, impassive eyes, a beautiful classic face, like Athena. He was staggered with astonishment. This could not be Yahweh. This was a woman, but like no woman he had ever seen. He did not know her. He did not understand who this was. Her voice was not Yah's voice, and this could not be Yah's visage. He did not know what to make of it. He was perplexed beyond the telling of it. Who had taken on the task of advising him? "Only Bethesda can determine that," he managed to say. The immigration agent paused uncertainly. His exterior harshness had evaporated. The female voice whispered again, and this time in his mind he saw her lips move. "Time is of the essence." "Time is of the essence," Herb Asher said. His voice grated in his own ears. "Shouldn't you be quarantined? You probably shouldn't be with other people. Those other passengers. We should have you on a special ship. It can be arranged. It might be better. We could get her there faster." "Okay," he said, reasonably. "I'll put in a call," the immigration agent said. "What's the name of this microorganism? It's a virus?"
"The nerve sheathing."
"Never mind. Go back to your seat." "Look." The immigration agent followed after him. "I don't know whose idea it was to send you on a commercial carrier, but I'm getting you off of it right now. There are strict statutes that haven't been observed here. Bethesda is expecting you. Do you want me to put in a call ahead, or is that all taken care of?" "She is registered with them already." This was so. The arrangements had been made. "This is really nuts," the immigration agent said, "to put you on a public carrier. They should have known better back at Fomalhaut."
CY30B, Herb Asher said.
"Whatever. I don't want any part of this. A mistake of this kind." The immigration agent cursed. Some dumb fool back at Fomalhaut probably figured it'd save the taxpayers a few bucks. Take your seat, and I'll see that you're notified when your ship is ready. It should... Christ! Herb Asher, shaking, returned to his seat. Elias eyed him. Ribis lay with her eyes shut. She was oblivious to what was happening. "Let me ask you a question," Herb said to Elias. "Have you ever tasted Laphroaig scotch?"
"No,"
Elias said, puzzled. "It is the finest of all scotches," Herb said. 10 years old, very expensive. The distillery opened in 1815. They use traditional copper stills. It requires 2 distillations.
"What went on in there?" Elias said. "Just let me finish."
Laphroaig is Gaelic for the beautiful hollow by the broad bay. It's distilled on Islay in the western Isles of Scotland. Malted barley. They dry it in a kiln over a peat fire. A genuine peat fire. It's the only scotch made that way now. The peat can only be found on the island of Islay. Maturation takes place in oak casks. It's incredible scotch. It's the finest liquor in the world. It's..." He broke off. An immigration agent came over to them. "Your ship is here, Mr. Asher. Come with me. Can your wife walk? You want some help?"
"Already?"
He was dumbfounded. And then he realized that the ship had been there all this time. Immigration was routinely prepared to deal with emergency situations, especially of this kind, or rather, what they supposed this situation to be. "Who wears a metal mask?" Herb said to Elias as he drew the blanket from Ribis, pushed back up over her hair, and has a straight nose, a very strong nose. "Well, let it go. Give me a hand." Together, he and Elias got Ribis to her feet. The immigration agent watched sympathetically. "I don't know," Elias said. "There is someone else," Herb said as they moved Ribis step by step up the aisle.
"I'm going to throw up," Ribis said weakly.
"Just hang on," Herb Asher said. "We're almost there." Big Noodle notified Cardinal Fulton Statler Harms and the Procurator Maximus, and then to all the heads of states in the world it printed out the following mystifying statement. On the standard of 50 they shall write, "Finished is the stand of the froward through the mighty acts of God, together with the names of the commanders of the 50 and of its tens. When they go out to battle, they shall write upon their WPSOX to form a complete front. The line is to consist of 1,000 men, 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 men. Each front line is to be 777 deep. One man standing behind the other. Stop. Repeat. All of them are to hold shields of polished bronze. Repeat. Bronze, resembling mirrors. These shields..." The statement ended there. Technicians swarmed over the AI system in a matter of minutes. Their verdict: the AI system would have to be shut down for a time. Something basic had gone wrong with it. The last coherent information it had processed was the message that the pregnant woman, Ribis Rami Asher, her husband, Herbert Asher, and their companion, Elias Tate, had been cleared by immigration at Ring 3 and had been transferred from a commercial axial carrier to a government-owned speed ship, whose destination was Washington, D.C. Standing at his no longer pulsing terminal, Cardinal Harms thought, "A mistake has been made. Immigration was supposed to intercept them, not facilitate their flight. It doesn't make any sense. And now we've lost our primary data processing entity, on which we are totally dependent." He rang up the Procurator Maximus and was told by an underling that the Procurator had gone to bed. "The son of a bitch," Harm said to himself. "The idiot. We have one more station at which to intercept them. Immigration proper at Washington, D.C. And if they got this far..." "My good God," he thought, "the monster is using its paranormal powers." Once more he called the Procurator Maximus. "Is Galena available?" he said, but he knew it was hopeless. Bulkowski had given up. Going to bed at this point amounted to that. "Mrs. Bulkowski?" the SL official said, incredulous.
Of course not. Your general staff, one of your marshals. The procurator will return your call, the SL functionary informed him. Obviously, they had orders from Bukowski not to disturb him. Christ, Harms said to himself as he slammed down the phone mechanism. The screen faded. Something has gone wrong, Harms realized. They should not have gotten this far. And Big Noodle knew it. The AI system had literally gone insane. That was not a technical breakdown, he realized. That was a psychotic fugue. Big Noodle understood something, but could not communicate it. Or had the AI system, in fact, communicated it? What, Harms asked himself, was that gibberish? He contacted the highest order of computers remaining, the one at Caltech. After transmitting the puzzling material to it, he gave instructions that the material be identified. The Caltech computer identified it 5 minutes later. Qumran Scroll, The War of the Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness. Source, Jewish ascetic sect Essenes. Strange, Harms thought. He knew of the Essenes. Many theologians had speculated that Jesus was an Essene, and certainly there was evidence that John the Baptist was an Essene. The sect had anticipated an early end to the world, with the Battle of Armageddon taking place within the first century CE. The sect had shown strong Zoroastrian influences. He reflected, John the Baptist, stipulated by Christ to have been Elijah returned, as promised by Jehovah in Malachi. Look, I will send you the prophet Elijah before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. He will reconcile fathers to sons and sons to fathers, lest I come and put the land under a ban to destroy it. The final verse of the Old Testament. There the Old Testament ended, and the New Testament began. Armageddon, he pondered. The final battle between the sons of darkness and the sons of light, between Jehovah and, what had the Essenes called the evil power? Belial, that was it. That was their term for Satan. Belial would lead the sons of darkness. Jehovah would lead the sons of light. This would be the seventh battle. There will be six battles, three of which the sons of light will win, and three of which the sons of darkness will win, leaving Belial in power. But then Jehovah himself takes command in what amounts to a tiebreaker. The monster in her womb is Belial, Cardinal Harms realized. He has returned to overthrow us, to overthrow Jehovah, whom we serve. The divine power itself is now in jeopardy, he declared. He felt great wrath. It seemed to the cardinal, at this point, that meditation and prayer were called for, and a strategy by which the invaders would be destroyed when they reached Washington, D.C. If only Big Noodle had not broken down. Glumly, he made his way to his private chapel. 9. The procurator said, We will wreck their ship. There is no particular problem. An accident will take place. The three of them, four if you include the fetus, will be killed. To him it seemed simple. At his end of the line, Cardinal Harms said, They will evade it. Don't ask me how. His gloom had not departed. You have jurisdiction in Washington, D.C., the procurator said. Order their ship destroyed. Order it now. Now was 8 hours later, 8 precious hours during which the procurator had peacefully slept. Cardinal Harms glared at his co-ruler. Or, he thought suddenly, had Bukowski been struggling to find a solution? Perhaps he had not slept at all. This solution sounded like Galena's. They had conferred, the two of them. They worked as a team. What a stale solution, he said. Your typical answer to dispatch a warhead. Mrs. Bukowski likes it, the procurator said. I dare say. The two of you sat up all night working that out? We did not sit up. I slept soundly.
although Galina had strange dreams. There's one she told me that, well, I think it worth relating. Do you want to hear Galina's dream? I'd like your opinion about it, since it seems to have religious overtones.
Shoot, Harms said. A huge white fish lies in the ocean, near the surface, as a whale does. It is a friendly fish. It swims toward us, I mean toward Galina. There is a series of canals with locks. The great white fish makes its way into the canal system with extreme difficulty. Finally, it is caught, away from the ocean, near the people watching. It has done this on purpose. It wants to offer itself to the people as food. A metal saw is produced, one of those two-man band saws that lumberjacks use to cut down trees. Galina said that the teeth on the saw were dreadful. People began to saw slices of flesh from the great fish, who is still alive. They saw slice after slice of the living flesh of the great white fish that is so friendly. In the dream, Galina thinks, this is wrong. We are injuring the fish too much.
Bukowski paused. Well, what do you say?
The fish is Christ, Cardinal Harms said, who offers his flesh to man so that man may have eternal life.
That's all very well, but it was unfair to the fish. She said it was a wrong thing to do. Even though the fish offered itself, its pain was too much. Oh, yes, in the dream she thought, we must find another kind of food which doesn't cause the great fish suffering. And then there were some blurred episodes where she was looking in a refrigerator. She saw a pitcher of water, a pitcher wrapped in straw or reeds or something, and a cube of pink food like a cube of butter. Words were written on the wrapper, but she couldn't read them. The refrigerator was the common property of some kind of small settlement of people, often a remote area. What happened, the way it worked, was that this pitcher of water and this pink cube belonged to the whole colony, and you only ate the food and drank the water when you realized you were approaching your moment of death.
What did drinking the water?
Then you came back later, reborn.
Harms said, that is the host under the two species, the consecrated wine and wafer, the blood and body of our Lord, the food of eternal life. This is my body. Take.
The settlement seemed to exist at another time entirely, a long time ago, as in antiquity.
Interesting, Harms said. But we still have our problem to face. What to do about the monster baby?
As I said, the procurator said, we will arrange an accident. Their ship won't reach Washington, D.C. When precisely does it arrive? How much time do we have?
Just a moment.
Harms pressed keys on the board of a small computer terminal.
Christ, he said.
What's the matter? It only takes seconds to dispatch a small missile. You have them in that area.
Harms said, their ship has landed. While you slept, they are already being processed by immigration at Washington, D.C.
It is normal to sleep, the procurator said.
The monster made you sleep.
I've been sleeping all my life. Angrily, the procurator added, I am here at this resort for rest. My health is bad.
I wonder, Harms said.
Notify immigration at once to hold them. Do it now. Harms rang off and contacted immigration.
I will take that woman, that Ribbeth Rami Asher, and break her neck, he said to himself. I will chop her into little pieces, and her fetus along with her. I will chop up all of them and feed them to the animals at the zoo.
Surprised, he asked himself, did I think that? The ferocity of his ratiocination amazed him.
I really hate them, he realized. I am furious. I am furious with Bukowski for logging 8 full hours of sleep in the midst of this crisis. If I had the power, I would chop him up, too.
When he had the director of Washington, D.C. immigration on the line, he asked first of all if the woman Ribbeth Rami Asher, her husband, and Elias Tate were still there. I'll check, Your Eminence, the bureau chief said. A pause, a very long pause. Harms counted off the seconds, cursing and praying by turns. Then the director returned. We are still processing them. Hold them. Don't let them go for any reason whatsoever. The woman is pregnant. Inform her. Do you know who I'm talking about? Ribis Rami Asher. Inform her that there will be a mandatory abortion of the fetus. Have your people make up any excuse they want. Do you actually want an abortion performed on her? Or is this a pretext? I want abortion induced within the next hour, Harms said. A saline abortion. I want the fetus killed. I'm going to take you into our confidence. I have been conferring with the Procurator Maximus. This is global policy. The fetus is a freak, a radiation sport, possibly even the monster offspring of interspecies symbiosis. Do you understand? Oh, the immigration director said. Interspecies symbiosis? Yes, we'll kill it with localized heat. Inject radioactive dye directly into it through the abdominal wall. I'll tell one of our doctors. Tell him to abort her, or tell him to kill it inside her, Harms said. But kill it, and kill it now. I'll need a signature, the immigration director said. I can't do this without authorization. Transmit the forms. He sighed. From his terminal, pages oozed. He took hold of them, found the lines where his signature was required, signed, and fed the pages back into the phone terminal. As he sat in the immigration lounge with Ribis, Herb Asher wondered where Elias Tate had gone. Elias had excused himself to go to the men's room, but he had not returned. "When can I lie down?" Ribis murmured. "Soon," he said. "They're putting us right through." He did not amplify, because undoubtedly the lounge was bugged. "Where's Elias?" she said. "He'll be back." An immigration official, not in uniform but wearing a badge, approached them. "Where is the third member of your party?" He consulted his clipboard. "Elias Tate." "In the men's room," Herb Asher said. "Could you please process this woman? You can see how sick she is." "We want a medical examination made on her," the immigration official said dispassionately. "We require a medical determination before we can put you through." "It's been done already. By her own doctor originally, and then by..." "This is standard procedure," the official said. "That doesn't matter," Herb Asher said. "It's cruel and it's useless." "The doctor will be with you shortly," the official said. "And while she's being examined by him, you will be interrogated. To save you time, we won't interrogate her, at least not very extensively. I'm aware of her grave medical condition." "My God," Herb said, "you can see it." The official departed, but returned almost at once, his face grim. "Tate isn't in the men's room." "Then I don't know where he is." "They may have processed him, put him through." The official hurried off, speaking into a handheld intercom unit. "I guess Elias got away," Herb Asher thought. "Come in here," a voice said. It was a woman doctor in a white smock, young, wearing glasses, her hair tied back in a bun. She briskly escorted Herb Asher and his wife down a short, sterile-looking and sterile-smelling corridor into an examination room. "Lie down, Mrs. Asher," the doctor said, helping Ribis to an examination table. "Rami Asher," Ribis said as she got up painfully onto the table. "Can you give me an IV antiemetic? And soon? I mean now? "In view of your wife's illness," the doctor said to Herb Asher as she seated herself at her desk, "why wasn't her pregnancy terminated?" "We've been through all this," he said savagely. "We may still require her to abort. We do not wish a deformed infant born. It's against public policy." Staring at the doctor in fear, Herb said, "But she's 6 months into her pregnancy." "We have it down as 5 months," the doctor said, "well within the legal period." "You can't do it without her consent," Herb said. His fear became wild. "The decision," the doctor told him, "is no longer yours to make, now that you have returned to Earth. A medical board will study the matter." It was obvious to Herb Asher that there would be a mandatory abortion. He knew what the board would decide, had decided. In the corner of the room, a piped-in music source gave forth the odious background noise of soupy strings. The same sound, he realized, that he had heard off and on at his dome. But now the music changed, and he realized that a popular number of the Foxes was coming up. As the doctor sat filling out medical forms, the Fox's voice could distantly be heard. It gave him comfort.
Come again. Sweet love doth now invite thy graces that refrain to do me due delight.
The lady doctor's lips moved reflexively in synchronization with the Fox's familiar Dowland song. All at once, Herb Asher became aware that the voice from the speaker only resembled the Fox's. The voice was no longer singing. It was speaking. The faint voice said distinctly,
"There will be no abortion. There will be a birth."
At her desk, the doctor seemed unaware of the transition. Yah had cooked the audio signal, Herb Asher realized. As he watched, he saw the doctor pause, pen lifted from the page before her. "Subliminal," he said to himself as he watched the doctor hesitate. "The woman still imagines she is hearing a familiar song, familiar lyrics. She is in a kind of spell, as if hypnotized." The song resumed.
"We can't abort her legally if she's 6 months along," the doctor said hesitantly. "Mr. Asher, there must be an error. We have her down as 5 months into her pregnancy. But if you say 6, then..."
"Examine her if you want," Herb Asher said. "It's at least 6. Make your own determination." The doctor rubbed her forehead, wincing. She shut her eyes and grimaced, as in pain.
"I see no reason to..."
She broke off as if unable to remember what she intended to say.
"I see no reason," she resumed after a moment, "to dispute this."
She pressed a button on her desk intercom. The door opened and a uniformed immigration official stood there. A moment later, he was joined by a uniformed customs agent.
"The matter is settled," the doctor said to the immigration official. "We can't force her to abort. She's too far along."
The immigration official gazed down at her fixedly.
"It's the law," the doctor said.
"Mr. Asher," the customs agent said, "let me ask you something. In your wife's declaration prepared for customs clearance, she lists 2 phylacteries. What is a phylactery?"
"I don't know," Herb Asher said.
"Aren't you Jewish?" the customs agent said. "Every Jew knows what a phylactery is. Your wife, then, is Jewish, and you are not?"
"Well," Herb Asher said, "she is CIC, but..."
He paused. He sensed himself moving step by step into a trap. It was patently impossible that a husband would not know his wife's religion. "They are getting into an area I do not want to discuss," he said to himself.
"I'm a Christian," he said then. "Although I was raised scientific legate, I belonged to the party's youth corps. But now..."
"But Mrs. Asher is Jewish, hence the phylacteries. You've never seen her put them on. One goes on the head, one goes on the left arm. They're small square leathern boxes containing sections of Hebrew scripture. It strikes me as odd that you don't know anything about this. How long have you known each other?"
"A long time," Herb Asher said.
"Is she really your wife?" the immigration official said. "If she is 6 months along in her pregnancy..." He consulted with some of the documents lying on the doctor's desk. "She was pregnant when you married her. Are you the father of the child?"
"Of course," he said.
"What blood type are you?"
"Well, I have it here."
The immigration official began going through the filled-out legal and medical forms. "It's somewhere." The phone on the desk rang. The lady doctor picked it up and identified herself.
"For you."
She handed the receiver to the immigration official. The immigration official, raptly attentive, listened in silence. Then, putting his hand over the audio sender, he said irritably to Herb Asher, The blood type checks out. You two are cleared. But we want to talk to Tate, the older man who... He broke off and again listened to his phone. You can call a cab from the payphone in the lounge, the customs agent said. We're free to go, Herbasher said. The customs agent nodded. Something is wrong, the doctor said. Again, she had removed her glasses and sat rubbing her eyes. There's this other matter, the customs agent said to her, and bent down to present her with a stack of documents. Do you know where Tate is? The immigration official called after Herbasher as he and Ribbis made their way from the examination room. No, I don't, Herb said, and found himself in the corridor. Supporting Ribbis, he walked step by step back down the corridor to the lounge. Sit down, he said to her, depositing her in a heap on a couch. Several waiting people gazed at them dully. I'll phone. I'll be right back. Do you have any change? I need a $5 piece. Christ, Ribbis murmured. No, I don't have. We got through, he said to her in a low voice. Okay, she said angrily. I'll phone for a cab. Going through his pockets, searching for a $5 piece, he felt elated. Yah had intervened, distantly and feebly, but it had been enough. 10 minutes later, they and their luggage were aboard a yellow fly cab rising up from the Washington, D.C. spaceport, heading in the direction of Bethesda Chevy Chase. Where the hell is Elias? Ribbis managed to say. He drew their attention, Herb said. He diverted them, away from us. Great, she said. So now he could be anywhere. All at once, a large commercial fly car came hurtling toward them at reckless speed. The robot driver of the cab cried out in dismay. And then the massive fly car sideswiped them. It happened in an instant. Violent waves of concussion hurled the cab in a downward spiral. Herb Asher clutched his wife against him. Buildings bloomed into hugeness, and he knew absolutely and utterly what had happened. The bastards, he thought in pain. He hurt physically. He ached from the realization. Warning beepers in the cab had gone off. Yah's protection wasn't enough, he realized as the cab spun lower and lower like a falling withered leaf. It's too weak here. The cab struck the edge of a high-rise building. Darkness came, and Herb Asher knew no more. He lay in a hospital bed, wired up and tubed up to countless devices like a cyborg entity. Mr. Asher, a voice was saying, a male voice. Mr. Asher, can you hear me? He tried to nod, but could not. You have suffered serious internal damage, the male voice said. I am Dr. Pope. You've been unconscious for 5 days. Surgery was performed on you, but your ruptured spleen had to be removed. That's only a part of it. You are going to be put into cryonic suspension until replacement organs. Can you hear me? Yes, he said. Until replacement organs available from donors can be procured. The waiting list isn't very long. You should be in suspension for only a few weeks. How long, specifically? My wife. Your wife is dead. She lost brain function for too long a time. We had to rule out cryonic suspension for her. It wouldn't have been of any use. The baby. The fetus is alive, Dr. Pope said. Your wife's uncle, Mr. Tate, has arrived and has taken legal responsibility. We've removed the fetus from her body and placed it in a syntho womb. According to all our tests, it was not damaged by the trauma, which is something of a miracle. Grimly, Herb Asher thought, exactly. Your wife asked that he be called Emmanuel, Dr. Pope said. I know. As he lost consciousness, Herb Asher said to himself, Yah's plans have not been completely wrecked. Yah has not been defeated entirely. There is still hope, but not very much. Belial, he whispered. Pardon me? Dr. Pope leaned close to hear. Belial? Is that someone you want us to contact? Someone who should know?
Herb Asher said, He knows.
The chief prelate of the Christian Islamic Church said to the procurator Maximus of the scientific legate, Something went wrong. They got past immigration.
Where did they go? They have to have gone somewhere.
Elias Tate disappeared even before the customs inspection. We have no idea where he is. As for the Ashers, the cardinal hesitated. They were last seen leaving in a cab. I'm sorry.
Bukowski said, We will find them.
With God's help, the cardinal said, and crossed himself.
Bukowski, seeing that, did likewise.
The power of evil, Bukowski said. Yes, the cardinal said. That is what we are up against.
But it loses in the end.
Yes, absolutely. I am going to the chapel now, to pray. I advise you to do the same.
Raising an eyebrow, Bukowski regarded him. His expression could not be read. It was intricate.
10. When Herb Asher awoke, he was told perplexing facts. He had spent, not weeks, but years in cryonic suspension. The doctors could not explain why it had taken so long to obtain replacement organs. Circumstances, they told him, beyond our control. Procedural problems. He said, What about Emmanuel?
Dr. Pope, who looked older and grayer and more distinguished than before, said, Someone broke into the hospital and removed your son from the Syntha womb.
When?
Almost at once. The fetus was in the Syntha womb for only a day, according to our records.
Do you know who did it?
According to our videotapes, we monitor our Syntha wombs constantly. It was an elderly bearded man.
After a pause, Dr. Pope added, Deranged in appearance. You must face the very high probability factor that your son is dead, has in fact been dead for 10 years, either from natural causes, which is to say from being taken out of his Syntha womb, or due to the actions of the elderly bearded man, either deliberate or accidental. The police could not locate either of them. I'm sorry.
Elias Tate, Herb said to himself, spiriting Emmanuel away to safety. He shut his eyes and felt overwhelming gratitude.
How do you feel? Dr. Pope inquired.
I dreamed. I didn't know that people in cryonic suspension were conscious.
You weren't.
I dreamed again and again about my wife.
He felt bitter grief hover over him and then descend on him, filling him. The grief was too much.
Always I found myself back there with her. When we met, before we met, the trip to Earth, little things, dishes of spoiled food. She was sloppy.
But you do have your son.
Yes, he said. He wondered how he would be able to find Elias and Emmanuel. They will have to find me, he realized.
For a month he remained at the hospital, undergoing remedial therapy to build up his strength, and then, on a cool morning in mid-March, the hospital discharged him. Suitcase in hand, he walked down the front steps, shaky and afraid, but happy to be free. Every day during his therapy, he had expected the authorities to come swooping down on him. They did not. He wondered why. As he stood with a throng of people trying to flag down a fly-car yellow cab, he noticed a blind beggar standing off to one side, an ancient, white-haired, very large man wearing soiled clothing. The old man held a cup.
Elias, Herb Asher said.
Going over to him, he regarded his old friend. Neither of them spoke for a time, and then Elias Tate said, Hello, Herbert.
Ribis told me you often take the form of a beggar, Herb Asher said.
He reached out to put his arms around the old man, but Elias shook his head.
It is Passover, Elias said.
and I am here. The power of my spirit is too great. You should not touch me. It is all my spirit now, at this moment.
You are not a man,
Herb Asher said, awed. I am many men, Elias said. It's good to see you again. Emmanuel said you would be released today.
The boy is all right?
He is beautiful.
I saw him, Herb Asher said, once, a while ago, in a vision that...
He paused. Jehovah sent to me, to help me. Did you dream? Elias asked. About Ribbus, and about you as well. About everything that happened. I lived it over and over again. But now you are alive again, Elias said. Welcome back, Herbert Asher. We have much to do.
Do we have a chance? Do we have any real chance?
The boy is 10 years old, Elias said. He has confused their wits, scrambled up their thinking. He has made them forget. But... Elias was silent a moment. He, too, has forgotten. You will see. A few years ago he began to remember. He heard a song and some of his memories came back. Enough, perhaps, or maybe not enough. You may bring back more. He programmed himself originally, before the accident. With extreme difficulty, Herb Asher said,
He was injured then, in the accident?
Elias nodded, somberly.
Brain damage, Herb Asher said.
He saw the expression on his friend's face. Again the old man nodded. The elderly beggar with the cup, the immortal Elijah, here at Passover, as always, the eternal, helping friend of man, tattered and shabby and very wise.
Zena said, Your father is coming, isn't he?
Together they sat on a bench in Rock Creek Park, near the frozen-over water. Trees shaded them with bare, stark branches. The air had turned cold, and both children wore heavy clothing. But the sky overhead was clear. Emmanuel gazed up for a time.
What does your slate say? Zena asked.
I don't have to consult my slate.
He isn't your father.
Emmanuel said,
He's a good person. It's not his fault that my mother died. I'll be happy to see him once more. I've missed him.
He thought, it's been a long time, according to the scale by which they reckon here in the lower realm.
What a tragic realm this is, he reflected.
Those down here are prisoners, and the ultimate tragedy is that they don't know it. They think they are free because they have never been free and do not understand what it means. This is a prison, and few men have guessed. But I know, he said to himself, because that is why I am here, to burst the walls, to tear down the metal gates, to break each chain. Thou shalt not muzzle the ox as he treadeth out the corn, he thought, remembering the Torah. You will not imprison a free creature. You will not bind it. Thus says the Lord your God. Thus I say. They do not know whom they serve. This is the heart of their misfortune. Service in error to a wrong thing. They are poisoned as if with metal, he thought. Metal confining them and metal in their blood. This is a metal world. Driven by cogs, a machine that grinds along, dealing out suffering and death. They are so accustomed to death, he realized, as if death, too, were natural. How long it has been since they knew the garden, the place of resting animals and flowers. When can I find for them that place again? There are two realities, he said to himself. The black iron prison, which is called the Cave of Treasures, in which they now live, and the palm tree garden with its enormous spaces, its light, where they originally dwelt. Now they are literally blind, he thought, literally unable to see more than a short distance. Far away objects are invisible to them now. Once in a while, one of them guesses that formerly they had faculties now gone. Once in a while, one of them discerns the truth, that they are not now what they were, and not now where they were. But they forget again, exactly as I forgot. And I still forget somewhat, he realized. I still have only a partial vision. I am occluded, too. But I will not be soon.
You want a Pepsi? Zena said.
It's too cold. I just want to sit.
Don't be unhappy.
She put her mittened hand on his arm.
Be joyful.
Emmanuel said, I'm tired. I'll be okay. There's a lot that has to be done. I'm sorry. It weighs on me.
You're not afraid, are you?
Not anymore, Emmanuel said.
You are sad.
He nodded.
Zena said, You'll feel better when you see Mr. Asher again.
I see him now, Emmanuel said.
Very good, she said, pleased. And even without your slate.
I use it less and less, he said, because the knowledge is progressively more and more in me, as you know, and you know why. To that, Zena said nothing.
We are close, you and I, Emmanuel said. I have always loved you the most. I always will.
You are going to stay on with me and advise me, aren't you? He knew the answer. He knew that she would. She had been with him from the beginning, as she said, his darling and delight. And her delight, as Scripture said, was in mankind. So, through her, he himself loved mankind. It was his delight as well. End of Side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.